have with us live in the studios once again, Job Parrish and Maria Tomchick, both with The Stake. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right. Starting out with local news and reusable bags.
Yes, the major retailers around town declared this reusable bag week.
Meaning that after this week, you can go back to using all those little disposable plastic bags forever.
Yeah, until the August 18th primary, anyway, where Seattleites will get a chance to vote on whether or not we want to impose a 20-cent plastic bag fee.
And why are we having that vote in the first place?
Well, we're having that vote because some major retailers and the American Chemistry Council, which, by the way, is not local, it's a national organization, got together a whole bunch of money and pushed the mayor and the city council to make it a ballot initiative to go back on the vote that they had that would have imposed the 20-cent bag fee and to make it an initiative to put it up to vote by Seattle residents. And so, of course, this week we get a bunch of major retailers saying, oh, gosh, you don't have to impose a 20-cent bag fee. We'll just encourage people to use reusable bags. This is really something that was proposed, I think. Was it Jan Drago or Gene Godden, one of the Seattle City Council members? I think it was Jan Drago who was against the 20-cent bag fee, and she said, no, it ought to be a voluntary thing.
Voluntary points mm-hmm. by large national corporations, I find, is usually the most effective way of ensuring a truly antisocial kind of policy.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so this week we get a single week out of the year where retailers are donating bags to food banks and other organizations and are encouraging people to bring their bags to the store. I just want to point out that places like Central Co-op, PCC, the Whole Foods, they give you a bag refund when you bring in your own reusable bag.
So does Fred Meyer, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And they just don't promote it very much.
Yeah, and some other stores will do it, too. But I think all stores ought to be required to do that. And that way, people would understand then that your 20-cent bag fee is already built into the price of your food. You're already paying it. You just don't know it.
Yeah, and the idea that they will actually take the money out of what you're paying into your consumer goods once, you know, it's no longer a cost is kind of laughable because they'll just keep charging it and call it profit.
Yeah.
All right, moving on to statewide and the governor restoring some funds this week.
Oh, yeah, this was a pretty controversial thing in the last couple weeks when it was discovered that in balancing the budget, the legislature had cut some $29 million from the state auditor's budget. This was funding that was provided under Initiative 900, a Tim Iman initiative that was passed in 2005, which took, I think it was 0.16% of the state sales tax and set it aside for the state auditor to conduct performance audits of various government entities around the state, including Seattle's port, a very valuable audit that pointed out some major issues that activists had been talking about in regards to the way the port did their business, but that had not had any major real audit done and has produced some pretty interesting results so far, and some results that would save the state government and local governments around the state a lot of money. And so Gregoire agreed this week to restore about half the funding to the state auditor's budget. That's good news, since the state auditor himself, Brian Sontag, admitted that he had a big surplus that he hadn't spent yet. He's going to turn that surplus over in a year when the state needs the money to cover other programs, but he's going to be getting back most of the funding that he will need in order to continue doing his performance audits.
Yeah, and let's be clear. The whole idea behind cutting the funding for Sontag's office in the first place was pretty much knee-jerk, we hate Tim Iman, which, you know, as problematic as many of Iman's initiatives have been, this one actually has been very good and as you know, dragged the Port of Seattle in particular, kicking and screaming into an era of quasi-accountability. It's the sort of thing where we don't like the messenger, therefore let's kill the message. And it's very good that Gregoire was found the political backbone to restore some of the funding.
Yeah, one of the more troubling things about the attempt to cut funding to the state auditor was that legislative Democrats had stuck in a a portion of the, they'd stuck a little line item into the bill saying that the state auditor could get money back if he proved that his audits were saving the state money. It really, it's called the bounty hunter provision because it, Sontag claims it would have turned him into a bounty hunter, which is exactly the wrong direction to go with something like this. The auditor needs to be independent. His work does not need to be based on the amount of money he collects from other government agencies. That's a clear conflict there, I think. So it was good that that Gregoire also cut that provision out when she restored the funding.
Yeah, it would also have fundamentally changed the mission of what the performance audits are supposed to accomplish.
Yeah.
Instead of helping an agency do its job better, it's all about how much money can the state collect, which is exactly the wrong approach.
All right. Moving on and talking about the Common Reading Program.
Yes, this is Washington State University is one of many schools that every year has a common reading program in which all the students read the same book during the course of the year. And I believe the students actually pick the book. But this year, those wacky students and I don't know, faculty members or whatnot were in all this also, picked Michael Pollan's Omnivore's Dilemma, which caused Washington State's president, Elson Floyd, to shut down the Common Reading Program.
Oh, no.
Because, at least one of the regents for Washington State University, who owns a 5,500-acre ranch, objected to Pollan's portrayal of big agribusiness. Washington State's president, however, says that the program is being cut due to the budget crisis after Washington State had already bought 4,000 copies of Pollan's book.
Oh, no.
Big agribusiness triumphs indeed. Oh. In related news, by the way, Washington State President Elson Floyd has taken a $100,000 voluntary pay cut for the next year in light of tightening economic conditions. Floyd made his request to the Board of Regents, which was reluctantly, quote-unquote, accepted by the board, who will reduce Floyd's salary from $725,000 to $625,000. A truly magnanimous gesture, I think. The pay cut, incidentally, one-ups UW President Mark Iman, who made a big show.
Emmert.
I'm sorry. Did I say Iman?
Yeah. You did.
Oh, dear. Emmert had declined any pay raise for the next year. According to the Chronicle of Higher Education, the two are among the highest-paid university presidents in the country, the heads of your public universities that are raising their tuition rates by 28% in the next year.
So we'll see if the students respond to that, having their selection cut from that's censorship, you know?
Do you think?
It's horrible. That is horrible. I mean, if I were a student at WSU, I'd be up in arms.
I'd have a beef about it.
I really would.
I'd have a cow.
Which are not hard to find over
there. What are they going
to
do? What are they going to do with the books? Have a book burning?
I wonder.
Maybe they'll eat their words.
Yeah. All right. All right, moving on to state bankruptcies.
That's actually a pretty impressive run of bad puns for this early in the morning.
I think so. Yeah, there was some somber news this week in the state. Washington State bankruptcies, that is business bankruptcies, have doubled since April of last year. And I just want to point out that really contributes a lot to unemployment as well as to personal bankruptcies in the state. Personal bankruptcies as well are up. About 9,750 people declared bankruptcy in Washington State in the first 4 months of this year. That's up 50% from last year. The counties with the most filings included Snohomish County, which had a 70% jump in personal bankruptcy filings, Clark County, King County, Spokane, and Pierce, so places where the most population live. Washington State as a whole was ranked 7th among states in the per capita increase in bankruptcy filings, although we're ranked 21st in our overall number of filings. That just means that the overall number of people filing for bankruptcy in Washington State puts us right at the middle of states in the nation. But when the increase in the number of bankruptcy filings puts us at 7th, that means that we're seeing the pace of bankruptcies picking up. That things are not getting better here. They're actually starting to get worse at a pretty quick clip. So
hey, we're a national leader. Woohoo.
Yeah, we're up there in the top 10.
All right.
So that's some somber news this week.
All right, and that leads us then into this week's national economic news.
Yeah, I just wanted to point out this week that the Wall Street Journal had a little article that they published where they took the Fed's worst-case scenario in the stress tests and applied them to about 940 local and medium-sized banks. Now, I just want to point out that the Fed stress-tested only the 19 biggest banks in the United States, and they didn't look at mid-sized banks or small local banks. But the Wall Street Journal said, well, let's get a picture of the total, what the totality of the U.S. financial system looks like.
And the worst-case scenario in this case actually probably isn't even as bad as things actually are, let alone is it the worst-case imaginable.
Right. We've talked about this the last few weeks, that the worst-case scenario under the Fed stress test is actually pretty mild. And what the Wall Street Journal found is that total losses among about 900 local and mid-sized banks could surpass $200 billion, and that 600 of those banks could see that their capital levels shrink so much that it would send up a red flag to federal regulators. I think that's pretty astounding. They found that losses on home loans could total about $49 billion, which means the rest of the damage would probably come from losses on commercial real estate loans. So you should think about that the next time you walk by that huge open pit at Second Pine downtown, or that big block-long crater that's on the west side of, on the east side of Green Lake, where there's supposed to have been built another Safeway or supermarket in that neighborhood.
That was mixed use building. The QFC is Stoneway and 40th. They're all over the city, actually.
No,
yeah,
it's
there's open pits everywhere.
Yeah, there are open pits everywhere. So you can think about that the next time you walk by one of those open pits that's been sitting there for a year or two or for several months. It's going to be another year or two at least before anything gets done with those things. So that's something to be considered. Now, I want to also say that one of the reasons we should be really concerned about these problems at local and mid-sized banks is that nobody's lining up to bail them out like they are the 19 biggest banks in the U.S.
They don't have lobbyists in Washington, D.C.
Right. They also don't have investors and hedge funds lining up to buy stock at a reduced rate and think, oh, this is going to take off because these banks will never fail. The Fed will always support them. Therefore, let's buy their stock now while it's cheap. Nobody's going to do that rescue for small and mid-sized banks. And those banks, if they fail or if they get taken over by the FDIC... Those banks, that's going to have a major impact on smaller communities all over the nation and on the jobs that people have and on people who are struggling to keep up. So
yeah, we're seeing that now in Clark County, where the Bank of Clark County failed earlier this year, and it's really put a hamper in the local economy because there's been no bailout for those folks.
Right, there's no bailout. And so far this year, 33 banks have been seized by regulators. That's more... Just in the first 4 months of the year, that's more than the 25 that were seized in all of last year. So that's also some grim news. But there was some good news this week on the economic front, at least on the regulatory front. The Financial Accounting Standards Board voted to end companies' use of off-balance sheet entities, or so-called special purpose entities. So you remember back when Enron and WorldCom failed? Well, one of the big features of their failure was Enron taking huge amounts of debt, running up huge amounts of debt, and then taking those debts and hiding them from investors and from regulators by putting them in these off-balance sheet entities, essentially creating new companies to set up that would just hold the debt for Enron or WorldCom. Well, you would think, of course, that... After those two companies imploded, that the Financial Accounting Standards Boards would have done something about making it illegal, making it not possible for companies to set up those kinds of entities. Well, they haven't until now.
In fact, I can remember at the time on this very radio program where we were talking, we were aghast at the failure to do that.
Yeah, at the ability to do that. And what we're finding now is that... there's finally a recognition that those special purpose entities were part of the cause of the implosion of the financial system, because big banks like Citigroup, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, you name it, have been doing that same kind of thing. Washington Mutual. What they've been doing is they've been setting up these special purpose entities in order to hide the risky loans that they've made. And now they're going to have to take those risky loans back onto their balance sheets. So they can no longer write these adjustable rate mortgages, package them all up and stick them in an off balance sheet entity and say, look at our balance sheet. It looks really good. We have X amount of commercial loans, X amount of home loans. They're high quality, et cetera, while over here in this hidden entity, they have like triple the number of adjustable rate mortgages sitting there waiting to implode. They can't do that anymore.
Yeah.
So that's good news.
And unfortunately, and we saw this a lot during the 8 years of the Bush administration, what happened in the interim is that for 8 years, an entire class of white-collar criminals got pretty wealthy off of continuing the abusive practices that should have been illegal all along, but were not. And now, fortunately, some of them are becoming unacceptable.
Yeah, and it's taken, 8 years since the fall of Enron and WorldCom for this rule to be passed. So regulation, you know, changes in the regulatory structure move pretty slowly when they should be moving pretty quickly on these things.
Glacial.
Yeah.
All right. And also this week, the credit cards.
Yeah, the regulating credit card bill passed in the House and Senate. It's going to go to Obama, and he is likely to sign it. It does several things that are good, but it does some things that are not so good. One of the most important things that it doesn't do is that it puts no limit on interest rates and fees that can be slapped on people, and it doesn't specify who credit card companies can make these kinds of adjustments on. So whether you have good credit or bad credit, whether you've always paid your payments on time, whether you make late payments, doesn't matter. Credit card companies can still slap the fees on you.
Yeah, we saw the original legislation that at one point anyway was thought likely to pass had many of those provisions. Mm-hmm. It put a limit on the usurious fees, the credit card, you know, the 25-30% per annual fees that the credit card companies can charge. It put a limit on, you know, what companies can do to yank around your credit line and so forth, regardless of what your credit rating is like. But the banking lobby basically gutted a lot of those provisions with the help of a number of congressional Democrats who crossed the line and voted with Republicans in order to kill those consumer-friendly protections, including, I don't have this in front of me, but I believe Patty Murray sided with the Republicans on those as well. So
I don't know the details.
So it was a very depressing vote 2 or 3 weeks ago, and now this is the final very watered down legislation that we're seeing instead. Legislation that a number of consumer advocates are really pretty dismayed by, because it should have been much, much tougher. And you know, if you can't pass regulation on unconscionable practices by credit card companies at this particular political moment, it's probably pretty unlikely you'll ever be able to do it. It really shows the power of the financial services lobby in Washington, D.C. compared to the interests of ordinary Americans.
Yeah, it really does.
Plastic wins again. All right, moving on. This week there was some new emission standards set.
Yeah, the Obama administration announced new emissions standards coming up. This is really in response to the California standards and the fact that 13 other states have lined up to want to adopt the California standards. And it's at the urging of all things, the automakers themselves saying to Congress, oh my God, help, saying to the Obama administration, oh my God, help us, we can't deal with differing emission standards in different states. There's got to be one national standard. And so the Obama administration complied, and basically what they did is they took the California standards and they said, okay, we're going to impose the California standards, but we're going to give the automakers a longer term in order to bring themselves into compliance.
65 years. No.
No, whereas the California standards would have been set in place fairly quickly, the automakers now have until 2012 to start phasing in the standards, which have to be in place by 2016, a good 7 or 8 years out. Cars will have to get 39 miles per gallon, which they could do today if they wanted to, and trucks 30 miles per gallon, which they should have been doing 10 years ago. But
let's be clear. These are mileage standards that were regularly achieved by vehicles in the mid-1970s after the first oil embargo by OPEC. And automakers decided over the years that it was more profitable to build bigger cars and to promote the market for bigger cars. And that's why we have the gas guzzlers of today. It has nothing to do with existing technology. It has everything to do with the greed of the automakers and their failure at this point to anticipate what the market would demand.
Yeah, one good thing about the new emission standards is there definitely an improvement over the old one. The new standards would get rid of the old offsets, which allowed companies to make autos that get less than the standards as long as they make ones with higher mile per gallon to offset them. So there won't be offsets under the new standards. Every vehicle will have to meet the standard, which is a good thing. But as Jav said, it's still a low bar. They could do better.
Yeah, and
they should do it sooner.
Yeah, they should do it sooner because, after all, climate change is not really going to wait for economic conditions to improve to make it more convenient for us to, you know, bring our environmental policies in line.
All right. And then finally on National Guantanamo.
Yeah, on Tuesday, which was a black day in D.C., Senate Democrats voted to strip funding from the funding bills for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. The $80 million they stripped was money set aside to close the Guantanamo detention facility. The House had already voted to do the same thing, but now the Senate has also voted to do it. That means that this funding will almost certainly be left out of the bill when they reconcile it and vote on it again. And really, it's the Democrats chickening out because the Republicans have made this a big issue that they've talked about. Oh, if you close Guantanamo, where are these detainees going to go? You're going to have to bring them on American soil.
Yeah, because people who have never been convicted of any crime are a threat to house in U.S. prisons. This may be one of the stupidest political arguments I've ever heard in my life, and that's a pretty sweeping statement.
Yeah.
But it really does put a new standard against which stupid can be measured. And congressional Democrats, to their eternal discredit,
fell for it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because we would want to be seen as tough on not being sufficiently tough on security.
Yeah.
All right, moving on to international and starting with Sri Lanka.
Yeah, good news for admirers of fascist regimes and authoritarian human rights nightmares the world over. Genocide works. We learned that this week in Sri Lanka, where the government finally found a way to end its decades-long civil war with the Tamil Tigers. It simply went in and destroyed women, houses, children, villages, creating a massive refugee crisis in areas where the rebels had been strongest. Hundreds of thousands of people displaced from their homes. Many, many civilians died. And the rebels, not particularly surprisingly, surrendered. So that war is now over. The only downside, of course, is that you now have areas of the country that were not in particular favor with the government because they had supported the rebels. Seeing a human rights catastrophe, and because it's one of those countries with a name that's kind of funny to spell in the English language, and most people don't really know where it is. It's an island off the coast of India, for people who are wondering. It got very, very little attention in American media, and actually not a whole lot of attention in the world media either, because it was overshadowed by another humanitarian crisis taking place at the same time. time in South Asia in the Swat Valley in Pakistan. And so, as we all know, Americans can't pay attention to two crises at the same time. It really was a discouraging moment because there was so little international outcry around this, and because we saw that, you know, when push came to shove, the government of Sri Lanka, with assistance from India, with assistance from the West, was able to defeat an insurgency basically by engaging in massive human rights abuses and violations and mass killings and reprisals. And it was very unfortunate to see that this didn't result in any kind of international condemnation particularly.
All right. And Israel.
Yeah, we had a much trumpeted meeting this week between the new prime minister, the new old prime minister of Israel, Netanyahu, and Barack Obama. Much of the media coverage of the meeting had to do not with the ongoing illegal occupation of Palestine. Heaven forbid that be mentioned, because there's really no fundamental difference between the American position and the Israeli position except for rhetoric. But with how tough the respective leaders could be on Iran. And this is particularly interesting because Obama gave one of his typical very measured kind of, even-handed policy statements that really didn't say or commit to much of anything. And the media in this country, particularly the New York Times, made a great show of reporting how tough Obama's message was, and that set a deadline for Iran to meet his conditions for negotiations, which was exactly what Obama did not say. It was what Netanyahu said and what the Israeli position represents, but it is not what the American position, at least under the Obama administration, has been. Not that the position will in any way, shape, or form affect the actual deeds of the United States, should those come into conflict with what Israel wants to do. But it was very interesting to see how even Obama's words were distorted on this issue by people eager to push conflict with Iran and what they perceive as Israel's national security interests.
Yeah, I guess the New York Times is falling into that common American media thing where they say, well, if he appears with the president must be giving sanction to what he says, and so that really is what Obama wants, you know.
Well,
and to a certain extent that could be true. You know that they probably clear each other's comments before, you know, they appear together. And I think, you know, that's sort of proves the wiliness of Obama to be able to make the same kind of statement that Bush would make in the past, but to have it be in somebody else's mouth so that then he can go back on it later if he needs to.
Unfortunately, the real audience for this is the international audience, and particularly mm-hmm. the Muslim world will see the American president appearing with, not to mince words, a war criminal like Netanyahu, mm-hmm. and they will draw the conclusion that the American leadership is really composed of war criminals too, which is not entirely inaccurate, but that's the conclusion that they'll draw regardless of what words have been said, because they're looking at the actual deeds.
Mm-hmm. Talking as we do every week with John Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with Eat This State. And where do people find Eat This State?
Eat This State is published every couple of weeks by local volunteers with local, national, and global news. You can find it wherever you find free publications, bookstores, cafes, King County Library System, and so forth. We're also on the web at www.eatthestate.org. There is our spring fund drive going on, so if you have an opportunity to donate and help this volunteer-run publication survive in the new media environment, we will be very, very appreciative. There's a PayPal button at eatthestate.org, or send checks or money orders or cash to P.O. Box 85541, Seattle, Washington 98145. And if you have comments, questions, tips, you missed any of that information and want to find out more, email us, our email info@eatthestate.org.